But I found myself working from home, screaming into my radio in my apartment alone. You understand?
How often does that happen?
Way too often these days.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here's Kristen Bry. And in for Steve Scafidi, here's Todd Albaugh.
Yes, indeed. Todd Albaugh is back in the chair, back in Milwaukee. And he has a lot of opinions today.
Coming in hot. I'm trying to decide the way in. Am I in a Steve Scafidi grumpy old man mood or Barack Obama, fired up and ready to go? I'm fired up and ready to go.
What's the difference between those two?
It's a fine line. Because I love it when Steve is on one of his, I don't care type of rants. Because he usually has a good
opinion.
Listen
better, be smarter.
That's right. If you don't like it, I don't care.
I'm going to hurt some people's feelings with this one.
Right. And Steve is getting a real tan.
A real tan. I'm like my fake
Bryan
tan.
Has a Republican tan.
Is that a quintessential Republican thing to get a spray tan? I don't think it is.
No, I'm just kind of making that up. But I mean, because yours looks natural. It doesn't look
except
orange.
In my hands right now. I screwed it up in my hands and it's a little blotchy.
I didn't see that.
So people watching the YouTube stream can maybe see my signs of a spray tan.
It is. Your face looks great.
Thanks. I look glowing. That's the point. Because I have my Be the Light Sojourner Family Peace Centers gala is tonight, which I'm co-chairing. So I thought I'd look a little extra nice.
Dazzling as always, Crystal Bry.
And so, so I'm looking forward to that. I'm looking forward for you being here. It is the first day of the World Cup, which I am very excited about. I have to admit that since, I would say, 2018... Mm-hmm. I was dating someone at the time who was French, and that's the year that France won. So I would say the excitement of getting to enjoy that year ever since has been very fun to be into the World Cup. And I think like many sports and big sports events, whether it's the NCAA tournament or even watching the Knicks last night, our poor friend Andrew Zimmel, who's one of the producers here, is a big Spurs fan. So he is on, we're on high alert for him to, a wellness check.
Wellness.
And, but sports, I love sports. I love the stories that come out of sports. And certainly there is a lot of stories coming out of this World Cup. So we're going to be talking to one of your old broadcast buddies who you went to a World Cup with in 1994.
When Chris, it was just a wee little eye sparkle.
I was eight.
8 years old. Yeah. Kevin, my old broadcast partner at, UW Platteville, and was on the air here at different stations in Milwaukee for a while. Now UWM, been there for 20 plus years, a director of marketing and trademark licensing type of thing. He is a World Cup soccer football aficionado. We went to the World Cup in 94 together when there was a game at Soldier Field, not in Indiana, but the one still in Chicago. And but he actually knows the sport. I think it's great. And there's actually a Milwaukee connection to UWM and the World Cup. Kev's going to tell us about that in hour two.
Nice. All right. So, yes, that's coming up at 11. But first, so Todd came in, like I said. He had a lot of thoughts. And I was a little scattered because I've got a lot going on. And so I was, like, not prepared. I hadn't had enough coffee. And Todd's just firing at me all the things he wants to talk about today, all the qualms he had with Joe and Bill a couple weeks back, and has some rebuttals for them. And so when we come back... So I think the thing that to remember, so Todd is Todd left the Republican Party.
2011.
In 2011. You've kind of been a man without a party for a while because you don't love this rendition of the Republican Party, but you don't necessarily consider yourself a Democrat. So you're kind of a free agent who can criticize everyone and call balls and strikes. Is that a fair way to put it?
The Frank Costanza of politics.
So when we come back... Todd has a lot of feelings about how the Democratic governor's race is playing out right now. And so I'm just going to wind him up and let him go. So if you would like to hear some criticism, stay tuned to Point Taken.
Not all one party.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry. Steve is out until Monday. Filling in for him today is Todd Albaugh, my good friend. And what did I just call you? A free agent? I mean, is that a fair way to put it? Like you would say you're a person. You care about politics a lot. You're super informed about them, but you're not necessarily a partisan anymore because it's not like you feel like you have a party.
I would consider myself a lean more fiscally conservative, but socially moderate. And I'm certainly not a Trumper. And I think that my former party based on the fact that they want to undermine voting rights, which is something very near and dear to my heart. I can't be there anymore. I voted straight Democratic ticket, I think, since 2012.
Okay.
If memory serves, because I think that that's the only major party that is pro-democracy. But I don't necessarily agree with the whole, you know, let's give loan forgiveness to everybody who ever signed up for a stupid college and put in $100,000 in loans. So, I mean, I'm not on that end of the spectrum either.
I mean, I think it's – this. Who was I just talking to about this? I was, you know, what we actually, it was kind of this report, right? And we're going to get to your criticism in a second. But it was in Washington Post. PBS covered it. But who actually did the study that there's technically nine political parties? And they've done stuff like this before. Mm-hmm. I think Steve and I took the quiz a long time ago. And I don't know if they've kind of readjusted what the parties are called. But I think that's, as far as people's actual belief system, they're much more nuanced than two options, right? And so I think this is something that gets at it. Are we going to have nine parties? Probably not. But when you talk to a lot of people, almost no one is all right or all left.
Yeah. Usually people are somewhere in the middle, but that Pew Research poll, and you and Bill talked about that. I listened to the show earlier this week with Kyle Wallace.
On
last Friday. I thought he was great. You guys got into this discussion, and this Pew Research poll was put out on PBS, gets to the nuance of it. You and I talked about it earlier. If you're a guy like Bill McCashin or Joseph Pecky, who are political consultants, it is easier and more cost effective to counsel your candidate to spend their money on the base, because this poll, the Pew Research, points out it is easier to get the base out to vote because people in the middle, the research showed, are usually less politically engaged and less likely to vote. And part of that is because they're frustrated with the partisanship. But if you're a partisan and you want to win an election, which is 50% plus one, you don't really care about those people in the middle, if I'm being completely honest.
Well, I think you care about people in the middle who have a high propensity to vote.
Correct.
But people who are unengaged, it costs more money to try to engage
them. That's a better way to say it.
Because there's certainly people who are, I mean, I think a lot of those people listen to the show, right? Like I hear from a lot of, we just had someone from the 920 text in. He described exactly the party that I want to be in. Why can't there be a common sense party?
Right.
Right. And so I think there is a lot of people who are engaged and are frustrated with both, but that you're talking specifically about the people who maybe vote in presidential election and that's about it.
They're low propensity voters. You hit it on the head, which leads me
to wind them up and let them roll.
I listen to the show as much as I can. 2 weeks ago, I love the Power Hour roundtable with Joseph Pecky and Bill McCashin. Both great guys. Deep respect for both of them. But I found myself working from home, screaming into my radio in my apartment alone. You understand?
How often does that happen?
Way too often these days. So the state Democratic convention is this weekend. I think it's in Madison. And you're going to hear Joe's going to come on and talk all this up tomorrow. And that's great. But I asked you before the show, because the listeners of this show are very smart.
Very smart.
And I asked the listener, what's been the biggest criticism in the news media the last 3 months from a Democrat? What's the biggest story about Democrats offering criticism the last 3 months?
What do you mean by offering criticism?
By going after someone. And the media has covered it. The answer is Tony Evers going after members of his own party over this botched up, quote unquote, compromise deal for education and tax rebates, which Joe and Bill, God love them, but they don't want to talk about structural deficits. Neither one of them. And you know what? Kyle Wallace hit it on the head last week with you. And you guys got, if you didn't hear last week, go back and listen to it. Great show. And you got Kyle to basically explain his vote. And he said, look, I don't care what happens 3 or 4 years from now. Just, I want the deal now. I want the now. And I would say that Joseph Pecky, whether he wants to admit it or not, has fallen under Trumpism.
What does that mean?
Because it has been the last 10 years of Donald Trump integrating into our thoughts of who cares about the future? Just get it now, baby. Just do the now. Just do the whatever is politically expedient now, and the future be damned. And Democrats have fallen into this trap, and Republicans certainly have. And if you would have asked Bill McCosian, when he was chief of staff to Tommy Thompson, you had to think about the structural deficit because the leader of the Republican Party in the Senate, Mike Ellis, was best friends with Bob Lang at the Fiscal Bureau, and they would never allow us. So here's the really quick thing. A structural
deficit. So who are you criticizing right now? I'm lost in the sauce as far as who are you mad at?
I am mad at both sides because they don't want to talk about this.
They don't want to talk about how bad the deal was.
Yeah, the deal was bad. Because
so you're criticizing Evers and the people who structured the deal.
Yes, and I'm also criticizing Republicans who put it forth as well. But nobody wants to talk about this, that it is going to matter 3 or 4 years from now if they would have enacted this. Your taxes would have gone up. You would have had to cut services or both. And that's why this deal is bad. And Tony Evers is going around criticizing Francesca Hong and Kelda Royce, who are the two strongest critics of this deal, because they know what's up. And they're actually fiscally conservative. They're actually responsible to the taxpayer. None of the other Democrats are doing that. So let me get it real quick for you. Here's the Democratic convention on the governor's side. It's down to 4 people. Francesca Hong, because she spent money early, she's leading the polls, and she has a built-in infrastructure of service industry workers in the state. Mandela Barnes, because he ran before and people know him. Democrats largely in the polling say we know the guy, we don't necessarily like him, but we know who he is. Kelda Royce, because she's the only Democrat that has a statewide endorsement from the Wisconsin Education Association, the teachers union. And Sarah Rodriguez, because she's kind of, you know, the sitting lieutenant governor, and she's out there. Missy Hughes, nice person, toast. Joel Brennan, nice person, toast. David Crowley, great county executive, toast. Forget those 3 people. Because suddenly Democrats woke up and said, oh, you know, it's spring, it's summer, let's start a campaign. Here's the fact. All right, we are 6 weeks, Kristen. The early voting for this primary starts on July 27th. We are 6 weeks away from early voting. You can't run an assembly race in 6 weeks, let alone a statewide gubernatorial candidate. So that's what it's down to. And I would say that Hong and Barnes are the front runners, Royce third, and Rodriguez kind of a fourth. I don't understand why Tony Evers has not been criticizing Tom Tiffany, who I'm not a Tom Tiffany guy, but I'll tell
you. What did you call him when you were on a putt?
A putt, yes. Yeah. But you know what? They've run the best campaign for governor so far in the state. And their TV ads, why I think they're on.
Well, there's also not a primary, right? It's like what?
Okay, but where the hell is the state party chairman, Devin Remiker? Why isn't the state Democratic Party running air cover for the Democratic candidates? And why aren't they attacking their Tiffany on this? They've done nothing. They've given Tiffany a free ride. It is unforgivable. And I don't understand, in a year where this should be a shoo-in for Democrats, how they could botch this up so far so poorly. It's astounding to me. If I'm wrong, ladies and gentlemen, is what we call a rant.
A rant. All right, let's take a break. Todd's going to take a breath. And maybe we'll come back and say what would have to happen post-primary for Democrats to...
Well, I've got a problem with the Republicans, too, so they're not off the hook.
There you go. We'll talk about that when we come back. This is Point Taken. He is Todd Alba. I am Kristen Bry. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, here with Todd Alba. Steve will be back on Monday. My husband just texted and said, Todd is cooking.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. So you said you also have some. We have about 3 minutes until the bottom of the other news, and then we're going to switch to education with Celestin Morgan from City Forward Collective. But you have some criticism for the Republicans, too.
News flash. I know I don't lead with this a lot, but I happen to be a gay man. It's Pride Month, as it turns out.
Yeah.
And I'm just so enormously disappointed in people who I usually respect going for the low-hanging political fruit and going after guys like James Tallarico. Because they happen
not
to be
gay,
who is also not trans, who is happens to be a single man.
No, he's not. He has a girlfriend.
Not married.
Okay. He's a hot girlfriend. She's pretty. She's very attractive. She's very attractive.
And they're taking the low hanging fruit, using words such as "quote unquote sissy" and other things that were going this guy. And it's just so vastly disappointing. And the reason they're doing this as a former Republican because they know their policies, such as their tariffs. And ICE and other things are not working. A war that's unwarranted, driving up prices, it's not working. I haven't felt as a gay man this much kind of anger and animosity probably since 2006 in Wisconsin when they passed DOMA, which is a whole other story, Defensive Marriage Act. And I would just
ask. Were you out by then?
No, I would say it was just before. I came out at 38.
38 years old,
yeah. I came out way late, way too late. And I think it's repulsive that I would just say, my granddad used to say, when you point the finger, there's 3 pointing back at you. So state Republicans, before you go attacking and making gayness and masculinity an issue, I don't know, maybe we should take a roll call. Start in the 1st Congressional District, an unmarried man. Maybe the 5th Congressional District, an unmarried man. Maybe we should go to the state Republican Party and look at leaders there who happen to be unmarried men and start delving into their private lives. And the thing is, Kristen, I'm not the only one who knows this stuff. So before people get too high and mighty on what masculinity is, check yourselves. And the real part of this is, the sad part, is the teenage boys playing hockey and football and baseball who happen to be gay and feel they're less than. And I can't come out because I might be made fun of. I might not be make the team. And you've done such a great job with Journey talking about mental health, Kristen. And I would add that who a person is, they need to be free to be themselves. And if you're struggling, thanks to Tammy Baldwin, and you need to talk to somebody, dial 988. 988, text or dial 988. Because there's help for you, and I'm telling you, folks, it does get better. I'm going to Gay Pride tomorrow night with my straight friend.
It's time for some forward thinking on Point Taken. Brought to you by City Forward Collective, focusing on education in Milwaukee.
Indeed, indeed. Celestin Morgan, Executive Director of City Forward Collective. You were just saying, it's been a while since you've had both Steve and I together.
It's always great to be on.
It's always great to be on. And so, as always, Todd Alba is sitting in for, not all, as always, yeah. As for the first half hour, he's still here, Todd Alba. All right, so I have not followed this story probably as closely as I should, as someone who is going to, well, we haven't decided where we're going to go to school yet. But for now, you know, we live in Milwaukee. I have a daughter, and there's a chance that we're going to end up in an MPS school. And so this week, the mayor of Milwaukee, Dr. Howard Fuller, the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, and Herb Cole Philanthropies all called out the Department of Public Instruction for blocking Milwaukee's biggest literacy push in a generation. So what is happening?
Yeah, so I'll give you two things here. You'll recall maybe 3 years ago, the state passed a piece of legislation, Act 20, which was supposed to improve how we teach early literacy or early reading, you know, to students up through third grade. There were fights about the funding. There were some very specific mandates around ending some of the worst practices and trying to do some of the best practices that we've seen in states like Mississippi and other states that have really moved the needle. That work is still progressing, but here in Milwaukee, separately, you know, we've talked before about, you know, our city having real challenges in terms of outcomes, you know, the nation's report card, the education recovery scorecard. I'm not overstating it to say that for students in general and for Black students in particular, we might be the most challenged district and city in the country in terms of reading outcomes. So if there's a place where this work has to happen in the state and in the country, it's here in Milwaukee. You've had 80 plus organizations and leaders from across the city, from the mayor to schools in every sector to civic and community leaders. You listed off some of them, all united around this shared challenge. Milwaukee needs to teach all of our kids how to read. And that begins with training our teachers to do that the right way. And that's really the genesis of the Milwaukee Reading Coalition. We're a part of it. It's really been co-chaired by Dr. Howard Fuller, by Joanne Anton, and the late Mark Saint. And together we've been trying to work to pull together a strategy to address the challenge of early literacy instruction and the work that needs to be done to train our teachers or retrain our teachers in these science of reading aligned practices, the best, you know, evidence-based approach to teach kids how to read. That's a long setup.
Yeah.
The challenge this week, the challenge that's come to light this week, and it's not a new challenge, is this requires resources. And there are private and philanthropic dollars that have been put on the table. The idea is let's pair those private resources with public dollars, let them all go further, make sure that we're starting by giving teachers good material and that they know how to use that material. And that's really where the training piece comes in.
I think, unlike my last half hour rant against both parties, I think it's important to remember, correct me if I'm wrong, keep me honest.
Yeah.
Act 20, unlike Act 10, Act 20 was a bipartisan measure.
Both
sides actually came together.
I have not found the legislator, the political, like, I haven't found the educator yet that's like, I don't want kids to learn how to read.
The sight words and what, like, the transition, right? Because that's the history of this, right? I remember, like, it was in the 90s that a bunch of states, including Wisconsin, changed their philosophy of how to teach people to read. I remember in Madison, my mom, now that I'm adult, there was some of our families who specifically went to private schools because they're like, I want my kid to have phonics. And now there's more research. I'm like, that was maybe a mistake. And so it's like reversing course, right?
Exactly. And, you know, there's more that sits around it. Phonics is at the core of it. But, like, it's exactly that. Like, we know how to teach kids how to read. It's maybe one of the few things that the evidence base has gotten pretty unarguable about. Unfortunately, we as a state were one of the last holdouts on making this transition. And so it means we are digging out from a deeper hole. And I don't hold any teacher responsible for that, right? Like, they're doing what they were taught to do. Act 20 also had some provisions, you know, not the issue right now, that were addressing how we were teaching teachers. But, like, we've got a set of teachers that have been trained for a generation in the wrong way to do this. We're going to have to reskill that teaching workforce to be able to do this in the right way. And that's really the core of what we're trying to get here. And that's why it's so frustrating. None of us, you know, nobody is happy with the outcomes for our kids. No one is blaming teachers or anything around this. We've got work to do. We need a willing partner in the state to get that work done.
So the timeline is Act 20 is passed and the holdup is money.
Yes.
The money to fund retraining teachers and to implement what is in Act 20. Is that specifically for Milwaukee or is this happening across the state?
So the Milwaukee Reading Coalition's concerns are specific to Milwaukee. But what obviously, I would tell you is that more broadly, you know, I think you would find lots of people who would say that the implementation of Act 20 has been, choppy at best. There was the fight about who had the ability to control and allocate the resources, and that took some time to litigate itself out. But I would say even beyond that, there have been broad and longstanding concerns around how DPI is implementing different portions of the law. And I think, you know, you'd find different people would have different frustrations, but I think you'd find most people in the education space would tell you, regardless of their orientation or viewpoint on the broader issues, that, you know, this is not something where DPI has gotten this right by any measure.
So to follow up on Kristen's point, where is the holdup? We've seen in the past it's been JCRIR, Joker, the state legislature not releasing funds. Mm-hmm. Is this a legislature or is this DPI and Dr. Jill Underly, the state school superintendent?
This is DPI and Dr. Underly, the superintendent.
So what's her problem?
And this, you know, right, the
I mean, you're not speaking for her, but, you know, what is her argument as you understand
it?
That's
saying?
A more fair
what
way.
What is their side of the story?
So, what has been laid out in the communications back and forth, and, you know, this at this point is now communications between the mayor of Milwaukee and the state superintendent. So when I say this is at DPI and Dr. Jill Underly, like, that's where I'm coming from with that. What they are saying is that within the law, there have been shifting stories. They said they didn't need enabling legislation to support the work of the Reading Coalition. Now they're saying that maybe they did. I think maybe the best way for me to sum this up is it feels like a bureaucratic back and forth. And what's getting lost in the middle are the needs of Milwaukee students, Milwaukee's teachers, and Milwaukee schools.
Because when did Act 20 pass?
2023.
Yeah.
We are like 3 years, and, you know, 3 years down the road.
I feel like when I started back at WTMJ, it had already passed. So, like, yeah, it's been a minute.
Even more than that, right, like, our kids get one shot at this, right? Yeah. Like, how many years of students have moved through, right? Like, we're now going into another summer. We're about to start another school year. Like, part of what the frustration is across the board, you know, is that there's no urgency coming from DPI, or it doesn't appear to be urgency from DPI about, you know, they fought for a while about who, you know, right, like the earlier fights that you're referencing, those have been resolved in DPI's favor. And they're still sitting on resources, you know, tens of millions of dollars of resources that could be deployed now to help retrain teachers, to help improve how we're teaching literacy to our youngest learners.
All right, let's take a quick break. We're talking to Kalestin Morgan, who is the executive director of City Forward Collective, and this is Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry, along with Todd Alba, who is filling in for Steve Scafidi, and we're talking to Kalestin Morgan, who is the executive director at City Forward Collective. Now, we have a text on the text line, because I think there is something to be said as far as, and we've talked many times when you've been on here, as far as the funding formula for schools and the argument that schools just need more money and all of this stuff that goes back and forth. But someone just texted saying, why do we need more resources to do what the schools are supposed to do? So what? How much money is allocated for Act 20? Like, what are we sitting on, and what is that money supposed to be going to?
Yeah, it's a good question. It's kind of hard to get a precise answer from DPI. The initial allocation was $50 million, or at least a portion that was, you know, sort of held up.
So it's just sitting there right now.
You know, and there are two things it's supposed to be used to do. Reimburse districts that need to get new curriculum. And I do think that there are some legitimate one-off expenses. If you bought a curriculum in 2022, let's say the year before the Act 20 passed, and it not aligned with the science of reading, I think it's reasonable for the state to cost share. I think it's a 50-50 cost share. It's reasonable for the state to pick up some of the cost of getting you onto the right curriculum. That means
like physical books, yeah, right? Which, physical, if you remember, yeah, college, aren't cheap.
Yeah, or these days, sometimes it's online curriculum. You know, MPS, for instance, made a mid-year switch. They had bought a curriculum, but they had bought an edition that was like partially aligned but not fully aligned. You know, I think we were talking about it back in January. It was a good investment, right? Like, getting the right materials in front of kids matters immensely. Mm-hmm. We know that's part of the sauce that has worked in other places. The other piece that's supposed to support is what we're talking about here, training teachers. And again, you know, this is a one-time expense, but if a teacher went through, like, you know, they went through education school in the 90s or the early 2000s, they just weren't taught the way to teach reading that we're asking them to do that now. It's reasonable, again, for us to say, let's do the one-time investments to make sure that we've got teachers who know how to do this in the right way before we, you know, so that we can actually see the results. Like, so those are the two pieces that were funded. And, you know, are there enough resources? I think it's a conversation that's a fair one to have, but there are resources. And I think it's hard to make the case for more when we haven't even gotten the resources out the door. And, you know, I'll just make one more point here, which is part of what I think is so frustrating about this situation with the Milwaukee Reading Coalition in particular is there are private and philanthropic dollars on the table. You know, the Greater Milwaukee Foundation, Herb Kohl Philanthropies, like major philanthropic leaders here in Milwaukee that have sort of anteed up alongside this, right? We talk a lot about public-private partnerships and making those public dollars go further. Here you've got civic leaders stepping up in exactly the way that you want to see that happen. You know, and still, crickets.
Great question by the caller, and keep me honest on this as well. I come from a family of educators. I'm not one, but correct me. Act 20, to your point, actually goes back to the way that we used to teach reading, which was phonics based. And we got away from that for so long. And they said, oh, actually, you know what? The phonics based way actually works better. And so the retraining for these maybe younger teachers who didn't learn phonics based, that's what a lot of this money is.
Well, that's what's also interesting to think about. Some of the teachers who didn't even learn to read through phonics, because if you think about it, if you're a teacher in your 20s,
right,
we've been teaching it the other way for long enough that how they learn could have been different too.
Absolutely. Both are true, right? You know, those who are a little bit older maybe recall the reading wars of the 1990s, you know, and early 2000s, like this debate and balanced literacy and whole language approaches. You know, I'm oversimplifying it, but like, do you look at the picture and guess the word, or do you know how to sound out F-R-O-G makes frog? That's sort of the conversation we're having. Like, the second way is the right way to do it. This is now pretty well established in the evidence, and the states that have focused or gone either never left that or gone back to that are seeing the results pay off.
And to Kristen's point, this was passed in 2023. So this, to the caller listener's question, this isn't new money this year. This was already budgeted and passed and signed into law 3 years ago. It's simply releasing the money now to these programs.
Exactly. And, you know, the need is urgent. I want to, like, start there again. I'm not overstating the case. You know, the Education Recovery Scorecard, Harvard, Stanford, and Dartmouth, the Nation's Report Card, you know, the NCS out of the Department of Education, like, these are national benchmarks. And by these national benchmarks, Milwaukee is not just below Mississippi. It's not just below Baltimore or Detroit, especially for our Black students. We are dead last in the nation. Like, I think last time I was on with Steve, I was saying, I didn't know you could get to zero percentile. We managed to get to zero percentile. Like, and that's not something that we should be proud of. Like, that's work we need to do. Here's a coalition trying to do exactly that work to ensure that, you know, our kids get one of the most fundamental skills they need in life. We need an estate partner that can step up.
So are the philanthropic dollars tied up because they're matching?
you know, they're tied up because they're matching. The idea here being, you know, wanting to make sure that all the resources are being allocated in the most efficient way possible. You know, and I understand that. I don't want to speak for any philanthropy individually, but I would say in the aggregate, right, like what's been laid down is a strategy that tries to braid these resources as best we can and use the public dollars where they are most effective so that the private, incorporated, and philanthropic resources can sit alongside it, right? Again, exactly the type of public-private partnerships that, you know, we want to talk about, where we talk about sort of civic and corporate champions stepping up, you know, and doing the hard work. Like, everyone is at the table. Like, you know, I don't know that there's a major stakeholder group in town that isn't in this conversation. You've got leadership from the mayor. You've got leadership from, you know, you name it in terms of civic and corporate leaders. You've got, you know, schools in every sector together. Like, we have not had this level of coordination and alignment as a city on a challenge around our students and education, certainly in my adult lifetime. And well, and like
that's saying something.
And like we need to like and it's necessary.
What's your ask of listeners out there? What can listeners do who may want action on this?
Yeah, if you look at the you know, we've issued a statement at City Forward Collective. I'd also direct you to the resource of the Milwaukee Reading Coalition. They're available on social media channels. There is a direct link to email or reach out to DPI leadership and ask them to come back to the table. You know, we need to find a solution and a way forward that ensures that every one of Milwaukee students, no matter the school they attend, gets the early literacy instruction they deserve.
All right. Website, cityforwardcollective.org. And what is your Substack?
You can find us at CFC_MKE on all our socials.
Perfect. All right. Kalestin Morgan, thank you as always for being with us. It's always fascinating to hear your perspective on all things Milwaukee and education. We'll be back after this. All right. We ran a little long with Kalestin Morgan from City Forward Collective, but when we come back, we're going to be talking about the World Cup and why, even if you're not a soccer fan, you should get into the World Cup and do yourself a favor because it is very fun. And I will die on that hill. So we will talk about that on the other side of this. And we also have a great guest named Garrett Bucks, local writer and organizer, doing a really cool 50-state relay race, but not the kind that you're probably thinking of. So stay here on Point Taken.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here's Kristen Bry. And in for Steve Scafidi, here's Todd Albaugh.
Welcome back, and I was reminded that Jeremy Janine, usually on at this time of the week.
Gone.
Thursday at 11, but he is gone. Well, I think also well-deserved vacation, if I remember correctly. But
perhaps minding the tchotchke shop.
Or maybe he's just doing that. Maybe they're doing something innovative over the tchotchke shop.
I think Steve's a little ticked off that I got to the tchotchke shop first. And it was not my intent.
Well, he can only be mad at himself.
I was trying to promote it and say this would be great. Video content, for God's sake.
I know. Maybe when he gets back, we'll finally get him there. All right. The World Cup starts today. I am very excited. This is a very fun world event. It is here.
Well, you're into it.
I am into it. But it is also, you know, it's here. It's Canada. It's the U.S. It's Mexico. And there is not a lack of stories already being told, both on the field, off the field, people getting into the States, cost of tickets, who the up-and-coming stars are, who the established stars are, and how they're going to do in maybe their last World Cup. So I am excited.
I'm thrilled. And you know, Kristen said we want to talk about this. I said, sure, here's my opinion, and our next guest can attest to this. My opinion of World Cup soccer has not changed in over 30 years. I look at soccer like I look at public transportation. I enjoy it if it works well. And the World Cup, it works well. And so joining us via phone, my longtime friend and former broadcast partner, we attended the 94 World Cup game at Soldier Field together. He took pity on a country boy from Richland Center. He also happens to be the director of trademark licensing here in Milwaukee at UWM. Once again, here is Kevin O'Connor. Kev, how are you?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you both for having me on. I could also not be more excited about the World Cup, and it is hard to believe it has been that long ago. Not that it was here, not that it should have been back, but when you think back then, and frankly, how far the sport has come in this country,
especially
in all of those years.
Absolutely. And so, all right, so now we have to ask, because you are such a football aficionado, are you going to go to any of the games despite how expensive the tickets have been?
So, yes, I was fortunate enough through some family connections. My family and I will be attending a game in Philadelphia coming up in a couple of weeks. So there is no doubt tickets are expensive. There is also no doubt for folks in certain in the cities that are hosting that many of the advertised prices have dropped significantly.
Okay.
And if folks are comfortable maneuvering around some of the secondary markets, of which another story is FIFA has their own secondary market where they are both charging sellers and buyers fees and collecting money for a second time on those ticket sales. But nonetheless, and again, obviously, you know, for those of us in Milwaukee, Kansas City is probably the closest drivable venue. I have made that, they've made that trip for youth soccer before. So it's 8-9 hour drive, right? That is not easy to just jump in the car and go. So we may be at a disadvantage, but in some other parts of the U.S. in particular, where maybe you're closer to a venue that's hosting a game, with the expanded World Cup up to 48 teams, another story. There are particularly some matchups where, whether it be a smaller diaspora here in the U.S. or just countries that aren't as maybe known for soccer, the prices, again, everyone has to judge what their level of comfort on prices is. But if I told you you could get into some World Cup matches at this point, for under $200, that sounds a lot better than the $3,000-$7,000 prices that have been thrown out and I think may still exist for certain matches.
Well, because was there a worry that some of the games wouldn't sell out if the tickets didn't? I mean, this is like the free market, right? Like at some point, like demand has to meet the price. And so there's still like, are we expecting the games to actually sell out?
I mean, that's I think that is a great question. It's seems to be an object of much debate, right? As someone who works on more of the retail and business side and my actual job, right? I think about that lens of like, you price things at some point and then it doesn't sell no matter how popular it is, right? And then you have to bring the price back down. I think what is challenged, what appears to be the biggest challenge in answering your question is that much of this, if not all of this, is being run through FIFA. So let's just do an example of the Bucks are hosting a playoff game at Fiserv Forum, and maybe they weren't able to sell tickets in advance. They just found out, right, add another game, whatever, put 2,000 on sale. I mean, they're going to put them out there. They're going to be on Ticketmaster. You're going to log out of Ticketmaster. You are going to literally be able to see. They are going to put every ticket they have available on sale at 10 a.m. tomorrow, and they want them all sold in an hour. And just from a business marketing standpoint, I guess. I'm not sure I understand the philosophy, but FIFA has chosen, it seems, to put tickets out in blocks, little bits at a time, and so it makes it very hard. You can go right now, literally, and buy tickets for every match. It is a bit more opaque to say whether those are tickets that someone has already bought and you are simply buying a resale ticket, or if, in fact, maybe FIFA has put those on the resale market, or they're funneling tickets out to some of those third-party vendors like SeatGeek and StubHub and pick your favorite of those. So there's it's like everything else with this World Cup. It's a lot, and I don't think we're going to know on any of these fronts, some of the other things you mentioned about this. I don't think we're going to know any of this until it like actually happens. You turn on the games and see like, whoa, section 212, there's nobody sitting there. Huh, I bet they screwed up and those tickets, you know, somehow got lost in the shuffle.
Yeah,
Kevin O'Connor is our guest on Point Take Along. Krista Bry, I'm Todd Alball. Kevin, a longtime friend, former broadcast partner, and currently the director of trademark licensing at UWM, talking about the World Cup. It starts today. Kev, you know, I appreciate really good soccer. When you and I went to Soldier Field, I've never seen a
field. Who did you guys see play? Which countries?
It was Germany and somebody else, wasn't it? I forget who.
It was Germany and Spain, as a matter
That's
of
right.
fact. We could not have stumbled our way into two more high-level countries, actually.
It was great, and the field, the only other field, playing field I've ever seen close to that is the Rose Bowl at Pasadena in person. It was a pristine, beautiful field that day, and well, they say it's the most beautiful game, football, soccer. And so I have appreciation, but speak, Kevin, to the listener who might be very Americanized, like, what the hell is this? Football is played by the Packers, not Spain and Germany. And also the lack of coverage. I mean, as it turns out, I don't watch a lot of Fox Television, who has most of the broadcasting rights on television. I mean, I see Marcelo Hernandez talking about in Spanish about football, but talk to the average listener today.
SNL actor for people who don't recognize that name.
why should people care about football? Why are people crazed about this around the world?
Boy, so I think for the first thing I would say to somewhat to I guess, counter your point ever so slightly, I think there are so many more people in this country now that truly do know what soccer or football is. And even if they don't consider themselves a big fan, maybe they only tune in for the World Cup every 4 years. I think the general base of knowledge is a bit higher. Certainly it is higher than it was 32 years ago for us, but that every year it advances, right? That the number of people who have a vague understanding of what offsides is, the number of people who aren't going to complain about a 1-0 result, but rather see the drama in the edge of the seat, nice edge, one goal will make all the difference in the world for one country or another. I think that number is going down, but there's no doubt it still exists. And that is the hook in many ways to having this event in this country, right? Is to capture a lot of those people. When you mention Fox in particular as the English language broadcaster in the U.S., right? They are hopeful for whether it's Friday night's match with Paraguay or perhaps a knockout round if the U.S. should advance, to draw television numbers similar to what they would draw for an NFL playoff game. We're not talking Super Bowl numbers in the U.S., but they realistically believe that to have 25 or 30 million people tune into a U.S. game of significance is not unrealistic, and that alone speaks to the number of people, the base, right, that is already connected to it. Answer your question, yeah. Go ahead.
No, actually, Kevin, let's take a break really quickly. We'll bring you back, because I also want to talk about the hopes of the United States men's team and where they are. We're also at an act of war with Iran and our rivaled history with that soccer team. So lots to get to with Kevin O'Connor. Stay with us on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Breyer along with Todd Alba, and we're talking to Kevin O'Connor. And we're talking about the World Cup. Kevin, big fan, knows a lot. And so let's talk a little bit more about the drama between established players, up-and-coming players, and also what are the prospects for a U.S. men's team? Because we're used to the women's team dominating, but men's team not always as competitive as other countries when it comes to soccer.
There is no question about that. Yes, for folks that are fans of the women's team, you're used to maybe snoozing through the group stage and just trying to figure out who they might play in some of the knockout games, and that's not true for the U.S. In fact, I was even taken aback by realizing that not since 2002 has the U.S. won a knockout stage game. That fairly famously is when the U.S. made the quarterfinals of the World Cup, and in the modern era is easily the best U.S. performance. I think that is the bar that this year's team is looking to meet, but I think there is understandable skepticism of whether that is realistic. The U.S. had one of the youngest teams in the World Cup in 2022 when they were knocked out of the round of 16. And the thought is, 4 years later, with frankly many of those same players of that golden generation taking the field this time around, that this is set up for things to go in a positive direction. But results have been mixed. There has been drama over the last 4 years in coaching with some players, all the usual things that happen in sports. So while it is very possible this U.S. team will excel and perhaps perform as well as any has in recent memory, I don't think it's off the table as well that they get knocked out in the group stage. So I think there is truly a range of possibilities over these next couple weeks for the home team.
All right, Kev, speed round. Unlike my old show, they actually have something here called sponsors. So we gotta keep this moving along, as it turns out. Messi and Ronaldo, final World Cup for both?
I think there's probably no doubt. I'd say Messi for sure. I mean, Ronaldo might try again. Portugal might let him, but I think, yes, this is the last one for both.
Who is the up-and-coming star to watch? Because I feel like the last couple of years it's been Mbappe, but now he's kind of a veteran. Who are the people that we should be watching that are new to the scene?
I'll give you one name, and I bet you will realize, oh, I've seen someone wearing that jersey. Lamine Yamal from Spain.
God bless you.
He was injured at the end of his club season, but he is potentially on his way to being the best player in the world. The thought is he might have to miss a group stage game or two, but Spain's going to be in the tournament for a while, and he is and will be a star.
Dark horses and underdogs.
Whew, boy, I think, how about this? I think the main thing you look for underdogs is you look for the host country, and in this case, we have three of them, right? I think it would be surprising if one of the U.S., Mexico, or Canada doesn't get as far as the quarterfinals, and that would be a huge result for any of those three host countries.
I'm pulling for Mexico, quite frankly. Weather, Kevin. You mentioned it, three different countries. We saw this with the Brewers going out to Las Vegas trying to play baseball in 92-degree heat. The desert didn't work so hot. Going from Canada to Mexico, how's the weather going to factor in?
Yeah, well, I think one saving thing, obviously, in some of our hottest places in the U.S. is they put roofs on the stadiums. So Atlanta and Dallas in particular come to mind as places you wouldn't want to play outside. But there's no doubt about it. Certainly the venues in Mexico will be hot and humid. Miami, hot, humid. Kansas City, New York, where the final is. I think the other, not just the heat, was the interruptions by storms, right? The idea that a match could be delayed multiple hours by storms, not something typically common at the World Cup.
And quickly, our connection to UWM, a little history there at World Cup.
There absolutely is. Thank you. Yes, right? Can have just a moment. Bob Gansler coached the U.S. team in 1990, the first one that got back to the World Cup in forever. He became the U.S. men's national team coach after being the head coach at UWM, where he brought along Milwaukee native Jimmy Banks to play on that 1990 team, who also played at UWM. And I mentioned that 2002 team. UWM's Tony Sana was one of the big players on that went to the quarterfinals. The World Cup runs deep at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee.
All right, and the final thing, we are in an active war right now with Iran. And I remember in 2022 when we beat Iran 1-0, and that was a huge game. And obviously, that was a big deal back then because that was right when the protests were happening and many citizens were getting arrested. So is there a scheduled game between United States and Iran in the early rounds, or is that something that could end up happening if either team advances?
So it is not in the early rounds.
Okay.
Paraguay, Australia, and Turkey A are the U.S.'s first three opponents. But if the U.S. finishes second in their group and Iran finishes second in their group, they would be slated to meet in the round of 32. So that is obviously not beyond the realm of possibility that there could be an elimination knockout stage match between those two countries.
Wow. Think of the possibility for the peace deal.
Happen,
right?
Seriously. I'm just saying, this is what sports are made out of, like high stakes and storytelling and the 100%. Characters and the athletes and the world politics and all of it. And so it's very exciting.
And I think I had heard that game would be in Dallas. I think so maybe Jerry Jones could help everybody out. Gosh. To make it all happen.
Kevin, better English quickly. English or Spanish, better to watch it in?
Boy, I'm going to tell you Spanish, to be honest with you.
Agreed.
I think you get the full flavor. You don't need to understand all the words. You can understand some of them.
100%.
The flavor is there in Spanish for sure.
All right, Kevin O'Connor, thank you so much for joining us. And go USA! All right, we'll be back with more after this. So, one more thing about the World Cup. Shout out to Alex Lazary, who was on the committee over in New Jersey and New York. And I had asked him, he was on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about it, and I had asked him very nicely if he could donate or if there was any opportunity for him to donate tickets to Sojourner's event tonight. And he came through.
Whoa.
And so one of the silent auction items tonight at Sojourner's event, Be the Light, is two tickets to... I don't even know which game it is, but I'm looking forward to see how much those actually go for.
And can people still get tickets for the event tonight?
No, it's sold out. Everything is sold out. But I'm excited to go. But I'm also excited to see how much people, because you have to get yourself to New York,
right?
So I'm wondering if that's going to be a hindrance to how many people will bid on them.
I think,
or if it can be a high price, like high ticket item. So
the guys were talking
more money
on the way in this morning. I was listening, of course, to 620 WTMJ. They were talking this morning that if the Knicks don't wrap it up in San Antonio, then the next game would be back in New York and it would coincide with the World Cup. So that could be a nightmare.
Wow.
Traffic wise.
All right. News is next.
This is a special report from ABC News. I'm Michelle Franzen. At the Pentagon, hazmat crews on scene, and sections of the Pentagon are on lockdown after...
Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen Bry, along with Todd Alba, who is filling in for Steve. We'll be back on Monday. And if you listen to the show regularly, you probably know how much I, how much of an extrovert I am, and that I am
really
out and about a fair amount. I like being around people. I like people in general. I'm a big believer in community. And so I was very interested in, a friend, but we follow each other on social media. Garrett Bucks is a writer and organizer in Milwaukee who also thinks a lot about the importance of building community and has now started an interdependence relay of 50 of gathering events across 50 states. And so I was interested in learning a little bit more about this. So welcome to Point Taken, Garrett.
Hey, it's really good being here. And you nailed those syllables. When I named this, I did not think about how hard it is to say interdependence relay. I should have just called it.
Well, you're a writer, not a broadcaster. So
the fun time gathering thing, right? Like, it would have been so much easier, but you nailed it. Yeah. 50 states, 50 gatherings. We started in April in Seattle. We're going to finish next April, most likely in Maine. And the thing that's traveling between each of these gatherings is this extremely large. Another thing I did not know about a year ago was how big boxes can be, but it's a large black walnut box with 50 compartments in it. And the idea is that everywhere we go, we're going to an event hosted by a group that's trying to do something really cool in their community. Some are religious organizations, some are neighborhood groups, some are friend groups, some, you know, have kind of a common shared interest. You know, we're most likely going to, you know, a punk rock collective of Native American kids in North Dakota. And then we're going to a group in Denver that just loves having breakfast together. They call themselves the Denver Omelets. So it's a wide variety of events that we're going to. But everywhere we go, the box goes. And that community will take a look, see what other folks have added to the box, and then they'll get to add a gift from their state and their community. So the stories that we're going to be telling is that, you know, across every corner of this country, you've got people who are really turning to their neighbors right now, and that story is unique to them, but it's also connected to something bigger. I really think there's something brewing here, and that's what we're trying to tell.
What are the great benefits of being friends with Kristen Bry? Some people collect memorabilia. Some people are car collectors, card collectors. Kristen curates people. And so I love the fact that you're here, and that's really super cool that I get the benefit of this. Our listeners do as well. Where did this idea come from? Because I think you nailed it. People right now are relying on authenticity and each other to get through some very stressful times right now.
That's right.
So where did this come from?
Well, probably from me having ideas and not thinking them through before I say go with them, right? That's a big piece of it. But not asking my wife before I decide to host 50 gatherings in 50 states. No, I think where it came from, I've had this privilege for a number of years now of getting to train people across the country and across the world who have been feeling this, right? This sense that, you know, we hear about a loneliness epidemic. We hear how divided we are.
Yep.
We hear, you know, all of us kind of feel the alienation, you know, of we were promised that social media was supposed to connect us. And made us feel, on one hand, a lot lonelier, and on the other hand, kind of a lot just angrier at each other, right? So I was introduced to the trainings I ran on how to build community groups to all these incredible groups across the country, but I felt like I was hoarding that information, right? I knew all of these stories, and so I've been trying to think for a while about how to tell those stories, how to connect some of those gatherers to each other, and how to show us that the people combating loneliness across the country are themselves not alone, that we're all doing it. And also that these are just regular people who started something, right? Like our host, I love the story of our first host in Seattle, a woman named Nicole Martin. She founded the Columbia City Neighbors Club. And Columbia City is a neighborhood in South Seattle. And it's the kind of neighborhood that has a lot of infrastructure that you think would enable people to get to know each other, right? They've got a light rail stop right there. They've got, you know, a lot of small businesses. They've got a really, really active farmer's market. But Nicole was going to that farmer's market every Sunday, and she had the realization that I have, you know, I live in River West. I have this realization when I walk around the neighborhood. I see these people. They're my neighbors. I see them at public events, at street festivals all the time, but I don't actually know them yet. So she had this idea. She just had the gumption to put up a sign up at that farmer's market. She did it for 5 weekends in a row and just said, would you like to meet a neighbor? And when people came over and met her, she both met them, and she signed up. She got their information. And that's how she built a 200-person neighbors club that is now the hub of this community, was just being willing to sit. You know, that's scary, right? But it doesn't take a lot of skill to sit at a table, just a little bit of putting your shame aside. And it got easier over time. The first week, she was alone. By the last week, a whole bunch of people who had come to her the first week were now sitting at that table with her and were enlisting people to join the neighbors club themselves. So wow. I get to tell stories like that. So that's where the idea came. How can I not, you know, get this out to the world?
Okay, we're talking to Garrett Bucks, who is a writer and organizer in Milwaukee and the founder of, so it's called the Interdependence Relay?
Yeah, the even longer one, because this is the 250th anniversary of the country, and obviously that's the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Officially, it's the Declarations of Interdependence Relay, but 9 times out of 10, I call it the relay. Our website is jointherelay.org for a reason. So I have options for you, regardless of how many syllables you want to say.
Perfect.
Right?
Yeah. All right, let's take a break quickly. Well, Garrett will still be here on the other side, because I want to hear some of the stories of parties that have already happened, or gatherings that have already happened, and what is planned, and what state still needs to sign up. So stay with us on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I am Kristen Bry, along with Todd Alba, filling in for Steve Scafidi, and we're talking to Garrett Bucks, founder of the Declarations of Interdependence Relay, 50 gatherings in 50 states.
Nailed it.
All right, so how many have already happened?
So we have had 5 already. We have the 6th one literally tonight. Nevada's going tonight.
Okay.
And then we have 6 through 10 are going kind of this next like few weeks or so.
Because did I say you already did Alaska and Hawaii then?
We did Hawaii. Alaska, we thought we were going to do Alaska first, but then we found this incredible school that wants us to come in February. Wait, when would you not come to Alaska?
Why would you not go to Alaska in February when there's no light?
But that's the thing. It's actually their celebration of the light starting to come back. Oh. And so we're like, we can't say no to that. But we have gone to Hawaii. You know, during the break, you asked me, you know, are you going physically to every one of these? And ideally, I would. But, you know, money, time, I've got 2 kids. Like, that's not in the cards. It pains me to say, I did have to attend in person the Hawaii event. You know, so, you know, I really am a victim here. This is a very, very,
it's a very
hard
long
project.
Flight.
Yeah. And the event was at night, and I had to go see some sights in the morning, right? Like, my life is terrible right now. Yeah.
So then, what are you looking for as groups are applying to be their state's gathering?
Yeah. So I want, you know, first I'll name what I'm not looking for, right? I don't need a certain size. I don't need a certain level of longevity. We've had groups that have just started. We've had groups that have been veteran groups. We've had really, really large gatherings and really large communities. And we're going to say yes to some really small ones. And so that's, we want that full variety. But what we want in every place is we want an idea that feels really connected to that place and what that place needs. And secondly, we want a host that is excited, you know, so is focused locally, but then wants to connect with others, is excited about learning from, okay, you know, I may run like a kind of a food truck park in Kauai, Hawaii, but I might have something to learn from this really, really interesting church in Portland, Oregon. I might have something to learn from this inclusive gym in San Francisco. So we want folks who are solving an interesting issue in their community or responding to an interesting need that's very specific locally to where they live, but do care about the broader story. And what we're discovering is doing that means that every event has felt really different and really connected to that place, but there's been a through line throughout all of them. And that's just really, really fun. Like, oh, your story in Idaho does have something to say to this story in Seattle, even though you're doing different things. Yeah.
I love every part of this because I think and Kristen and Steve discuss on this show politics a lot. I think there are political solutions. I actually think that real change and progress begins what you all are doing and projects like this. What have you heard of the events that have happened so far? What's the top feedback that comes to your mind of people who participated that say, I went to this end?
Yeah, I would say what's at every single one so far, the other side of that "and" is, and I want to go back. And that's what's important, right? Because, you know, what we're discovering over time is, you know, like I said, we've got some events that are groups that are really, really new, some events that are groups that have gone on for a while. And what we're discovering is, you know, there's no magic to this, to reconnecting communities. It's really simple. If you show up in the same place with the same people for extended periods of time, and I think we can all think of examples where this has been true for us, you start caring about those people. And if the space was set up well for you, if it gave you a good welcome, if it cared about you, if you felt like you had a home there, eventually you're going to start having ideas for how to make it better, right? And so it's not, you know, a lot of our groups and gatherings started with one organizer, right? I told that story of Nicole in Seattle. But Nicole in Seattle now has most of the events run by the Columbia City Neighbors Club are coming from other people, right, who just started attending the events, but it mattered enough to them that they wanted to then welcome folks into other things. Nicole's like, I didn't want to do neighborhood clothing exchange, but somebody else did, right? In Hawaii, I mentioned, you know, we went to Kauai, one of the northern islands, and that's a place where a lot of the infrastructure, you know, Kauai has 70,000 residents, and about 70,000 folks come every week as tourists, right? So a lot of the infrastructure on that island is built for tourists, and locals don't have a ton of great third spaces and gathering spaces. And our host in Hawaii is trying to build one of those. And it started as a food truck park. But as they started getting to know the vendors of the food truck park then connected them with other folks of saying, hey, you know, the guy who runs the pizza shop at the food truck park said, you know, you've got this big grassy area. My buddy is one of the most renowned Polynesian dancers and fire knife dancers on the island. You, for your events, for your gatherings, you should have him and his family do their performances. And so that's what we did at the Interdependence Relay. Was, so we've had a lot of cool events, but I don't think anyone is going to beat in terms of the amount of fire spun around in the air as our Hawaii event. But that's the idea, that you make the space, people want to come back, and then they start adding to it.
All right, let's take one more break, and when we come back, I want you to give advice or resources for people who are interested in doing this work, even if it's not a part of the Interdependence Relay. So stay with us on Point Taken. All right, we've got to have about a minute and a half left, but I didn't want to let Garrett Bucks leave before giving some resources or advice to people, because obviously there's going to be one event in Wisconsin for the Interdependence Relay, but we want more than just one event. So for people listening right now of wanting to learn how to do this in their community, what advice or resources would you point them to?
Well, first I'll say, if you do want to be the event in Wisconsin, or if you're listening elsewhere and want to be the event in your space, we take applications on a rolling basis. We've not done the application review for Wisconsin yet, so you still have a chance. Join the relay.org. But the more general advice I'll give is, it sounds like a bit weird, but like, start not with the question of what you think other people need. Start selfishly with the question of, what do you wish a neighbor would invite you to do? What's your need? And that you're not going to end up selfishly. You want to jump from that to thinking, well, if I need that, I bet others do too. And so start from the thing you're craving, the thing you wish existed, and then start asking people, saying like, am I alone here? Would anyone else want to do this too? And that's how you're going to find your people.
All right. And now that we know that we're neighbors, we have some work to do in our neighborhood.
We discovered this. This is why one does this. Right. Yeah.
All right. Garrett Bucks, thank you so much. Jointherelay.org. Todd Alba, as always, so much fun when you're here.
Thank you.
You've taken a breath. I think you've calmed down since the beginning of the show. Congratulations.
Yeah.
All right. We'll be back tomorrow with Joe and Bill for the political power hour. News is next. Thanks for listening.